Every time we wiggle a toe or form a thought, our brain is sending electrical signals. These signals literally broadcast what the brain is doing at any moment. Now scientists are figuring out how to eavesdrop on this broadcast using a computer connected directly to the brain. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, the approach is revealing new information about how we control our muscles, listen to sounds, and communicate.
What's making all this possible is actually an old technology. It's called electrocorticography, or ECOG. Surgeons place electrodes on the surface of the brain. Those electrodes detect the brain's electrical signals and send them to a computer running special software. That's the new part. Gerwin Schalk is a researcher at the Wadsworth Center in Albany, New York, who helped design that software. He says the system can decode brain signals so precisely that it can tell whether you're thinking of the word bat or cat.
This is both very exciting and somewhat frightening at the same time, because it really goes pretty close to what people used to call mind reading.
ECOG, minus the software, has been around since the 1950s. Doctors use it to figure out which part of the brain is causing seizures in people with severe epilepsy. About a decade ago, a small group of scientists wondered whether the technology might be able to do something a lot more sophisticated.
Corey, can you close the hand for me, please? That's great, thank you.
Perhaps ECOG could pick out the brain signals we use to control our fingers, or even the signals our brain sends out when we just think about moving our fingers. Schalk shows me a video. In it, he's working with a young man who is staring intently at a computer screen. The video was shot by the American Museum of Natural History as part of an exhibit on the brain.
Can you open it back up? Okay, keep it open.
What's striking about this scene is that the young man's own hand isn't moving. What is moving is a virtual hand on the computer screen. The man is clenching and unclenching this virtual fist on command using only his thoughts.
Close it, close it, close it. Great job.
Like all volunteers in ECOG experiments so far, this patient has severe epilepsy. He took part in the experiment while doctors were using ECOG to find the source of his seizures. But the experiment shows how the technology could help a very different sort of patient, someone paralyzed by a spinal injury or Lou Gehrig's disease. ECOG could allow someone like that to operate a robotic arm with just their thoughts. Schalk says the experiment also shows how much of the brain gets involved in things we take for granted.
Even for simple functions such as opening and closing the hand, for example, there are many, many areas that contribute to the movement.
Bionic arms are just one likely use for ECOG, though. Eric Luthard is a brain surgeon at Washington University in St. Louis who has worked closely with Schalk. He says the technology has proved to be far more powerful and versatile than anyone expected.
I'd say every couple weeks we find something that really kind of makes us scratch our head and say, wow, that's pretty neat.
Luthard says ECOG hits a sweet spot between two competing approaches to detecting brain signals. One of these requires placing electrodes deep in the brain. That allows scientists to monitor individual brain cells with great precision, but they can't monitor very many brain cells at the same time. Another approach is to put electrodes on the scalp, but the signals are much less clear because they pass through skin and bone. Luthard says ECOG involves surgery, but not going into the brain itself.
We basically do what's called a craniotomy, where we make an incision in the scalp, make a large window of bone. We put the array over the brain. We close everything back up. And then there's wires exiting through the skull and through the scalp, which then get directly connected to a computer.
In theory, researchers could receive signals from hundreds or even thousands of electrodes. So far, they haven't gone beyond dozens, yet the results have been spectacular. Schalk shows some of what ECOG can do in his lab. No animals or test tubes here. But there are plenty of computers, including one playing music.
The music is The Wall by Pink Floyd.
Schalk is showing me the results of experiments he did using ECOG to monitor people as they listened. He points toward two waveforms on the computer screen. One shows the mountains and valleys that represent changes in the music volume. The second waveform looks almost the same, but it represents the electrical signals generated by the brain in response to the music.
This is the actual loudness in the music, the decoded loudness in the music. Okay? Very close correlation between the actual loudness in the music that is just playing right now and the music, the intensity of the music that we're decoding or inferring from the person's brain. I mean, isn't that pretty awesome?
Zhang says the brain signal is so distinctive you could almost recognize the music from the waveform alone. What's really awesome, though, is the next part of the experiment.
So what we did was we played some music to the subjects, and then we played the same music again, except that now every about 10 seconds, there was a one-second silence period. All was just in
the wall. Silence in the room, but not in the brain. Even when the music stops, the waveform from the brain continues.
All in all, it was just a brick in the wall.
Schalk says what we're seeing is the brain's attempt to fill in the missing sounds.
The brain basically tells us a lot of information about the music in the times when there's really no music. It's not played.
Whether it's musical phrases or strings of words or scenery we look at, our brains are always filling in missing information. Schalk says ECOG is also revealing things about how the brain creates speech. He and other researchers are using the technology to watch the brains of people as they speak out loud and also as they say the words silently to themselves.
One of the surprising initial findings coming out of that research was that actual and imagined speech is very, very different.
Schalk says when your brain wants you to say a word, it produces two sets of signals. One has to do with moving your muscles.
And that makes sense. First, you have to move your mouth around and your vocal tract around so as to produce a particular type of verbal output.
And there are also signals coming from the auditory system. On the other hand, when a person simply thinks of a word instead of saying it, there are no muscle signals, just the activity in the parts of the brain involved in listening.
And that seems to suggest that what imagined speech actually really is, it's more like internally listening to your own voice.
So it should be possible to use ECOG to decode what we're actually thinking. Schalk says he hasn't quite done that yet, but he's close. In one experiment, the system tried to recognize several dozen unspoken words in the minds of volunteers. It was right about half the time. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And you can watch videos of these experiments, including a patient controlling a virtual hand with his mind, at our website, npr.org. This is NPR News.
A lawsuit in New Jersey addresses an issue that has cropped up in several places, making video recordings of police officers in action. A high school student in Newark, New Jersey, claims that police detained her illegally after she used her cell phone to shoot video of on-duty cops. Some law enforcement groups say that filming the police will only lead to second-guessing officers who have to constantly make judgment calls. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
There are more than 280 million cell phone subscribers in the U.S., and many of those phones are also portable video recorders. With so many cameras in pockets and purses, clashes between police and would-be videographers may be inevitable. Consider what happened to Kalia Fitchett.
I was leaving school, and I got on the bus to go downtown.
Like many teenagers, Kalia Fitchett uses her cell phone to record videos. A lot. The 16-year-old Fitchett was riding a city bus when two police officers got on to deal with a man who seemed to be drunk. Fitchett decided this would be a good moment to take out her phone and start recording. The police did not agree.
One of the officers told me to turn off my phone because I was recording them, and I said no. And then she grabbed me and pulled me off the bus to the cop car, which was behind the bus.
The police erased the video from Fitchett's phone. She was handcuffed and spent the next 2 hours in the back of a squad car before she was released. No charges were filed, but now it's Fitchett who's suing the Newark Police Department for violating her civil rights. Deborah Jacobs directs the New Jersey chapter of the ACLU, which helped bring the lawsuit.
All of us, as we walk around, have to understand that we could be filmed or we could be taped, but police officers, above all others, should be subject to this kind of filming because we have a duty to hold them accountable as powerful public servants.
The Newark Police Department did not return calls for comment, but Newark is not the only department that's tried to discourage its citizens from filming on-duty cops.
Get off the motorcycle. Get off the motorcycle.
In this video from 2010, a state trooper in Maryland flashes his gun while pulling over motorcyclist Anthony Graber for speeding. When Graber posted the video from his helmet cam on YouTube, prosecutors charged him with breaking the state's wiretapping law because he recorded the state trooper's voice without consent. A judge dismissed the case, but that hasn't changed the opinion of some in the law enforcement community who say video recording is potentially dangerous for cops.
They need to move quickly in split seconds. Without giving a lot of thought to what the adverse consequences for them might be.
Jim Pasco is executive director of the Fraternal Order of Police.
We feel that anything that's going to have a chilling effect on an officer moving, an apprehension that he's being videotaped and maybe made to look bad, could cost him or some citizen their life or some serious bodily harm.
There's always going to be a pocket of police officers who are resistant to change, but I think the vast majority of police have been acclimated to the reality that what they are doing is likely being recorded at any given time.
Tom Nolan is a former police officer who teaches at Boston University. He says police in Massachusetts train their officers to tolerate video recording as long as no other crime is taking place. And Nolan thinks departments around the country will eventually do the same.
The police will get the message when municipal governments and police departments have got to write out substantial settlement checks. Standing by itself, that video camera in the hands of some teenager is not going to constitute sufficient grounds for a lawful arrest.
Lawyers for Kalia Fitchett in New Jersey say her detention was illegal, but Fitchett says she'd think twice before filming police in Newark again.
It would have to be important enough to get myself in trouble for, I guess.
Because you think you could get in trouble again?
I think so, yeah.
That's a question the courts will have to answer, because no one expects teenagers or the rest of us to stop shooting video with our phones. Joel Rose, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. For years, security experts have been warning that the country's banking and telecommunications systems, its power and transportation grids, as well as its oil refineries, are all vulnerable to cyber attack. Computer networks underlie that infrastructure, and if they're shut down, daily life could be paralyzed. And yet, steps to improve the nation's cybersecurity have stalled due to disagreements over what exactly should be done. Well, today the White House laid out its own proposal for improving the nation's cybersecurity, and NPR's Tom Gelton is here with us to talk about that. Tom, first, why has it been so hard to get folks to agree on a plan?
One reason, the infrastructure that we're talking about, the banks, the power grid, the oil refineries, telecommunications companies, is almost entirely in private hands. Close to 90% of this critical infrastructure is in the private sector. And, Robert, if you look at computer systems generally, you've got the military network, the .mil network, that's very well protected. You've got the .gov networks, somewhat well protected. But then you've got this .com domain that's the least protected. Basically, each company up to now has largely been on its own. There hasn't been much of a role for the government. The government doesn't have the legal authority to take charge of protecting private networks. If that's the change, you need new laws, and that's what's difficult.
So what is the Obama administration proposing?
Well, actually, they're proposing that private companies would still be responsible for their own cybersecurity. They'd have to come up with their own plans. The idea is that they know best what threats they face and how to counter them, but they would be required to come up with a plan. That's the key. The government would define which companies are under the critical infrastructure. They would then be required to come up with a plan, which the government would evaluate, decide if it's adequate or not. If they're not satisfied, the government would report that. It sort of would be a name and shame approach. On the other hand, if the government approved the plans, that would be a good review for them.
Well, given the vulnerabilities of the nation's computer networks, is that approach enough? Is it sufficient?
Well, the fact that it's entirely voluntary is, I guess, a little controversial. There are various legislative proposals in this area. The White House proposal is just one, and some of the others are actually quite tougher. The main Senate bill, for example, would include fines and penalties for companies that don't come up with an adequate cybersecurity plan. That is an area of disagreement. A senior official who briefed reporters on this proposal today said the position of the Obama administration is that the government doesn't have all the answers here. He said we want to enable innovation, not hamper it.
Tom, these sound like measures that are designed to prevent or defend against an attack. But what if there were a full-scale cyber war and these systems were targeted? Does the administration's proposal address that possibility?
You know, Robert, I've asked that question, and the truth is that those who are more focused on this prospect of cyber war, and that would be largely on the military side, are not entirely satisfied with the way things are going. They're saying that if there were a full-scale cyber attack, someone would have to be in position in the government to take command, orchestrate the government response across all agencies, give orders. And in this regard, one provision in some of the congressional bills would be to create an Office of Cybersecurity, a cyber czar, who would have clear authorities in this area. There is a White House cyber coordinator now, but he doesn't have those authorities. This is one of the issues that is going to have to be worked out.
Did you hear any reaction today from industry or from members of Congress?
Generally positive, generally seen as a step in the right direction. I think industry is relieved that the White House is emphasizing a voluntary approach. There are several provisions of the White House proposal that have to do with simplifying requirements and standards, and of course, industry likes that. Also, generally favorable reaction in Congress.
Tom, with so much involved here in Congress, also in business, what are the likely next steps?
Lots of negotiation, Robert. Very complicated issues here. There are some 50 bills out there that have to be reconciled. Not all members of Congress are really well-versed on these issues. I spoke to one person who's heavily involved in this effort. He said, Robert, very delicately, that the next thing that's needed is to have some member education up there on Capitol Hill.
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Tom Gelton.
Great mathematician John Nash, the subject of a movie A Beautiful Mind, once described his delusions from schizophrenia in this way. Quote, I started to see crypto-communists everywhere. I started to think I was a man of great religious importance and to hear voices all the time. I began to hear something like a telephone call in my head from people opposed to my ideas. The delirium was like a dream from which I seemed never to awake. Scientists have observed these sorts of symptoms in many schizophrenic patients. But the big mystery is what exactly causes the hallucinated conversations or the tendency schizophrenics have to slip from one topic to another in mid-sentence or to mix themselves up in these intricately imagined plots. How do you figure all that out? Well, one way is to look at a bunch of computer patients. Computers programmed to have a similar sort of behavior. And that's what my next guest has done, and his cyber tinkering has allowed him to derive some new theories about schizophrenia. That research appears in the journal Biological Psychiatry. Dr. Ralph Hoffman is professor of psychiatry at Yale University School of Medicine in New Haven, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you very much. Very pleased to speak with you here.
What made you try to create a model on a computer about schizophrenia?
Well, primarily because these are such vexing manifestations of schizophrenia that are so still so poorly understood. And then along with that, there are so many theories and ideas about what might be causing these problems. So what we ended up doing essentially is developing an artificial neural system implemented on computer, an artificial brain, simplified, but basically then inducing a wide range of hypothesized illness mechanisms and to see which one actually seemed to produce the better fit in terms of what we were seeing clinically and experimentally with actual patients.
And so do you have any idea what's behind the, you know?
Well, that's the big question. So we simulated about 8 different core disturbances and with this system and compared it, as I said, to human behavior. And both the artificial neural systems and the humans were given tasks of remembering and recalling stories. So actually what surfaced was a clear-cut, at least statistical, winner in terms of the problem that did the best in terms of simulating these patients, and that was what we now term as hyperlearning.
So you had you had one.
Yeah, we landed one.
landed hyperlearning, did you call it?
Yes, hyperlearning.
And what does that mean?
Well, what it means really is that in the artificial neural system, that particular modules, networks within the system were engaged in a learning process. So they were essentially fed stories of certain sorts, and they had to learn the stories and put them in an abstract form that enabled the stories to be actually downloaded into essentially a permanent memory in this artificial system. And then the system kind of unwound that process in the other direction, was able to take these memory traces and recreate the story. So what we found is essentially is if this memory consolidation process was accelerated to an excessive degree, that the system began to confuse different stories or memories and to corrupt these representations in very specific ways that seem to be suggestive of certain language manifestations of schizophrenia. And the reason why this is of potential importance is that in the real human brain, that when we have experiences interacting with others, seeing things on television, whatever, that the common way that we parse these experiences and organize them and remember them for ourselves and to tell other people about it is through stories. So stories are a critical kind of organization for information, particularly social information, and really makes us who we are as individuals, the stories that we tell in some sense. So so these stories, like other episodic memories, when we experience them and register them in memory, take a long, long time to become incorporated into a permanent store. So, so what this study really suggests essentially, so we're talking weeks to months. So initially when we have these experiences and have memories in our minds about what we've gone through or what we've experienced or seen, that it's kind of a snapshot or a set of snapshots of these experiences. But then gradually these are incorporated into more abstract story structures that are related to other stories that we have learned and remembered. So there's a generalization process and an efficiency-making process.
Is there any way that you can incorporate what you've learned from your computers into helping people?
Yeah, well, just to finish out the story. So what it really says is the reason why the human brain has to do this so slowly is that if it actually speeds it up, that that memories become intermingled and corrupted in certain ways, and it might actually, we're hypothesizing, produce the manifestations of what we call schizophrenia.
And as far as helping people now, using what you know?
Well, what we need to do is press on, and we need to do some... We have, I think, an interesting hypothesis and some preliminary supporting data, because this study was actually done in comparison to a group of actual patients. What we need to do now is to look directly in the brains of these individuals and to see if this hyperlearning process can be confirmed, not just through their manifest language behavior, but using certain kinds of neuroimaging. So that's what we're pursuing now.
Well, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Good luck to you.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Ralph Hoffman, professor of psychiatry at Yale University School of Medicine in New Haven. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
The boom in car ownership in China has brought with it many problems familiar to Americans. Bad traffic, of course, and more pollution. So the Chinese government and the auto companies are trying to push a new generation of environmentally friendly cars. As Rob Gifford reports from Shanghai, that's not proving an easy task.
When it comes to razzmatazz, executives at the Shanghai Auto Show last month showed they could roll out a new product with the best of them.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ford Motor Company's Director of Global Electrification, Nancy Gioia.
But Nancy Gioia had the somewhat unenviable task of persuading a Chinese public in the first flush of gasoline-powered capitalism to park the Hummer and roll out the Ford Hybrid. 80% of Chinese car buyers last year were first-time purchasers, and Gioia is under no illusions that getting China to go green will be easy.
One of the challenges we have in China is not that electrification will come, It's that our desire to have it tomorrow can't be met because the customer has to be willing. And so here in China, the second large challenge is infrastructure.
The challenge of infrastructure is that most urban Chinese people live in high-rise apartment blocks, so charging electric or hybrid cars is difficult. Undeterred, Chinese companies have jumped into the green car business too. One such company from the southern city of Shenzhen is BYD, which stands for Build Your Dreams. Senior marketing manager Paul Lin is hopeful. He says he thinks the dreams of Chinese drivers are less entrenched than their gas-guzzling American and European counterparts.
People are familiar with life with car and petroleum combined together, but for Chinese, we don't like have that kind of a habit to using this kind of car. So we can be easy to change.
Inside the cavernous exhibition hall, there was a presentation of a new model of green car almost every minute, usually with a tall, beautiful female model draped across its hood. But even tall, beautiful female models may not yet be enough to persuade the Chinese public. The green technology is not mature enough yet, says 25-year-old visitor Tang Xuejun. I won't consider buying a green car for at least 4 or 5 years. 30-year-old Guo Bing won't be buying an electric car either, since he has nowhere to charge it. Then there's also the huge problem of Chinese government oversight and regulation, or lack of it. John Zeng of auto consultant JD Power says the government wants to see people buy more cars to boost industrial growth, but there are a whole array of different standards for charging stations and batteries.
If you want to new industry to grow up, you need to have a clear guidance. If there's no standards, that means if you are a consumer, if you buy a BYD E6 in Shenzhen, if you want to drive this car to other cities like Shanghai, you're probably going to have big trouble because they have totally different charging stations.
In other words, says Zeng, the supposedly all-powerful one-party state is not intervening and controlling enough. From an environmental point of view, there is some hope in the fact that many Chinese only drive an average of 5,000 miles a year. The government discourages people from driving longer distances through huge tolls on national highways, says John Zeng, even as it builds up an extraordinary high-speed rail network.
3 years ago, when I traveled from Beijing to Tianjin, we drive a car. It took more than 3 hours. And last year, I traveled from Beijing to Tianjin again, and I took high-speed railway, 28 minutes. So I think it's the government way is try to build up enough railway system to reduce the reliance on the car.
Encouraging people to buy cars, but then encouraging them not to drive them, is one of the more delicious paradoxes of modern China. It looks likely it will continue to be a crucial tactic as the electric and hybrid market in China struggles to take off. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Shanghai.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Innovation and originality are close cousins. We think of creative innovators as people with new ideas. But to read Malcolm Gladwell on the subject is to be reminded of a distinction. An innovator may not be the one with the new idea, but the one with a new take on an old idea. Gladwell's article, Creation Myth, Xerox PARC, Apple, and the Truth About Innovation, appears in the May 16th issue of The New Yorker, and he joins us from New York. Welcome to the program once again.
Thank you.
You deal with a fabled and, you would say, somewhat misunderstood event in the history of Silicon Valley. Steve Jobs sees a mouse. What happened?
Yes, well, there was a Xerox in its heyday, when it was one of the great American tech companies in the late 60s, sets up this legendary R&D facility in Palo Alto in Silicon Valley called Xerox PARC, and staffs it with the greatest computer scientists in the world. And over the course of the 70s, they essentially invent virtually everything that we associate with the personal computer, the desktop computer, the mouse, Windows, the Ethernet, the laser printer, everything comes out of there. And in 1979, Steve Jobs, who was then a 24-year-old entrepreneur from down the street, comes to visit, and he sees the mouse. He's never seen a mouse before. Mm-hmm. And he starts jumping up and down and says, this is the future, right? And he also sees the fact that they had icons on the screen, and they would click on icons on the screen with the mouse, and they would open and close windows. And he's never seen this approach to computing before. And he drives back to Apple, this little tiny startup company, and he says, stop what you're doing. This is the way to do a personal computer. And the result of that is the Macintosh.
Right. The rest is folklore. Now, he had a deal, actually. He wasn't stealing something from them.
No, he gave them, they invited him in exchange for the right to invest in Apple Computer.
So the folkloric moral of this story is that the nimble, future-oriented Apple picks the pocket of the hidebound dinosaur Xerox. And you say that's an extreme reading of what happened.
Yeah, that's the way this story has been told 100 times. I mean, it's a staple myth of Silicon Valley. And it's very often told in a way to suggest that Jobs is the thief in the night and Xerox is the hapless dupe. And I think that's an uncharitable and inaccurate reading of that narrative.
And we should say here that Steve Jobs came away from looking at a very expensive and somewhat clunky mouse, yes, and saying, we've got to make one that works better and it's much, much, much cheaper.
Yeah, when the mouse that Jobs sees and so inspires his curiosity cost about $300 or $400 to make, was this sort of big clunky thing with 3 buttons on it, and didn't work very well because, you know, it only worked in a kind of pristine environment when you were rolling it on the right kind of surface. And Jobs realizes that he has to transform that if he's going to make it a commercial product. And he famously goes to this guy named Dean Hovey, who was one of a big industrial designer in Silicon Valley who'd worked with Jobs for years. And he says, I've seen this thing, but my version can't be $300. It must be $15. And my version can't have 3 buttons. It must have no buttons. And my version has to work on everything, including Formica. And so he, you know, the notion, that's why I so object to the notion that he stole the idea from Xerox PARC. He didn't. He understood that it had to change in a dramatic way before it could be commercially viable.
Now, you invoke an analogy here in terms of innovation as to how the revolution in military affairs took place. And you talk about 3 different militaries that took part in a revolutionary development of drones and AWACS and a variety of things. The Soviet military that thought it up, the U.S. military that built it, the Israeli military that used it all.
Yeah, this is an argument that's made in a really brilliant book by a guy named Dima Adamski called The Culture of Military Innovation. And he simply points out that it's the Soviet Union in the 70s, a cadre of intellectuals there, who conceive of this on a conceptual level, who realize that digital technology is going to change the way we fight wars, but they don't do anything with it. And then in America in the 70s and early 80s, all of these technologies are developed. They actually make the gadgets. You know, they make the drone and they make the precision-guided missile. But it's Israel that really puts all these things together and uses them in a war, in the Lebanon War of 1982, for the first time. And Adamski's point is that there's a reason why that revolution happens in a different way in 3 separate places at different times. And that is that the thing that makes you good at conceptualizing makes it difficult for you to make the object. I mean, modern technological revolutions are so complex that one party can only ever master or innovate in one sort of specific area. So we shouldn't think about revolutions having an inventor. We should only think of them as having inventors.
So those 3 roles in the development of the modern arsenal would roughly have analogies in industry here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we wrongly fetishize being first in a technological revolution because, you know, the Soviets are the first to think about the revolution in military affairs, but the revolution is so complex that means that they're not around when it actually comes to fruition in the field. Similarly, Xerox PARC is first to come up with all these technologies, but the very thing that makes them first makes it difficult for them to capitalize on the technologies. You don't want to be first, right? You want to be second or third. Right? You don't want to be... Facebook is not the first in social media. They're the third, right? Mm-hmm. Similarly, you know, if you look at Steve Jobs' history, he's never been first.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't first with the desktop computer, wasn't first with the laptop, was way late with the MP3 player with the iPod, and was massively late with the iPhone. Right? He was 6 years late to the smartphone business, and yet now he, you know, has this dominant position. So it's a very, you know, maybe we're wrong, and, you know, we go around thinking the innovator is the person who's first to kind of conceive of something, and maybe the innovation process continues down the line to the second and the third and the fourth entrant into a field.
Well, Malcolm Gladwell, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
And Malcolm Gladwell's article in the May 16th issue of the New Yorker magazine is called Creation Myth, Xerox PARC, Apple, and the Truth About Innovation.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to keep photos, music, and other files safe from computer mishaps. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.